Good morning and welcome to the first episode of KLI's Lumen Podcast in 2025.
And happy Women's History Month to all of our listeners. Fun fact, we're actually filming this episode on International Women's Day.
And just to refresh your memory, the Kravis Leadership Institute is the leading institute on Claremont McKenna College's campus in terms of student leadership development, research, development crews, and opportunities for cutting-edge and even student-led research alongside accomplished faculty members. Some of our current research includes women in leadership development, leadership in tech, race in leadership, and competency mapping, amongst many others.
The Institute also facilitates leadership dialogues, faculty workshops, and events for the entire student body. We run annual conferences, including the Kravis Day Roulette Conference, which is going on this weekend. It brings together scholars and professionals in leadership for engaging discussions, panels, and workshops. But now we are super excited to kick off the first KLI Illumin episode of 2025. My name is Vivian Arndt. I'm a freshman here at CMC. I study public policy with a sequence in gender and sexuality studies, and I'm on the logistics management team for KLI. I will be one of your podcast hosts this year.
And my name is Nathan Mahendran. I'm a freshman at CMC also, studying economics and data science. I'm on the competency mapping research team at KLI, and I will also be a podcast host this year. Our first guest is Dr. Lisa DeFrank Cole, Professor and Director of Leadership Studies at West Virginia University. Dr. DeFrank Cole is a Fulbright Specialist Scholar and award-winning author with a focus on women in leadership. She dedicates her work to empowering women and encouraging conversation about the value of women in society and in the workplace. Dr. DeFrank Cole has published award-winning books such as A Research Agenda for Gender and Leadership and Women in Leadership, Journey Toward Equity, alongside our very own visiting assistant professor, Dr. Cheryl Tan.
So without further ado, welcome to the Illumin podcast, Dr. DeFrank Cole.
Thank you both. It's a pleasure to be here.
Amazing. So just getting started, once again, thank you for joining us today. Many of us here at KLI and across Claremont McKenna's campus in general are aspiring leaders, and we often seek to embody Claremont McKenna's motto involving responsible leadership. Nearly every student I know has a story behind their pursuit and passion for leadership involvement. So I was wondering, what inspired you to enter the field of leadership and also decide to become an advocate for women in the workplace?
I'll answer that question in two parts, with the first being, why did I enter the leadership field? So I have a doctorate in higher education administration, which at the time, there was no path to getting a PhD in leadership studies per se. So it was from that particular field that I transitioned into becoming a professor of leadership. I wrote a doctoral dissertation about the differences in male and female leadership styles of college and university presidents. And we said male and female because at the time we weren't looking at gender on a spectrum. I wasn't anyway. I didn't know those terms. So I think that kind of sparked my interest specifically in the leadership field. And I began teaching classes just as an invited lecturer at my institution. And after that, I really loved it. And I felt like, gosh, this is my path. This is really what I want to study. And I think why women in leadership was because I had experienced gender bias as an undergraduate. I have an undergraduate degree in landscape architecture, which was largely male-dominated at the time that I was going through it. And I didn't have the words to actually label what I was feeling or what I was experiencing. And I was curious that I didn't know why I wasn't having my questions answered as a woman student in the program when I felt like some of the men might have had their questions answered. I had all male faculty members. And so I think through some of those experiences, being a good student, I thought, what is this rub? What is this feeling that's going on? And so, yeah, it started this curiosity. And so I blended the two together eventually. So I did not become, I graduated with a degree in landscape architecture, but I did not become a practicing landscape architect. And I think part of the reason was because of this feeling that I had that I just didn't belong, that something wasn't quite right. So I went on for this career in higher education administration instead, which led me to leadership when it came about on my campus to actually get to teach it.
Wow. Yeah. And I think, unfortunate enough, that is something that a lot, I mean, maybe us, a lot of people on this campus experience, that sometimes you don't always see yourself in leadership. And thank you for sharing your experience. That's super inspiring. I think a lot of us can see that move to want to become a leader when it's something that you don't get to experience in your own learning.
Mm-hmm. So you actually mentioned that you weren't aware of the gender spectrum earlier. And I think it's very interesting that today we're talking about gender and leadership, and this is also something that has been a conversation for a while, and you talk about that a lot in your research. So I wanted to begin by just asking if you could deconstruct that term. How do you define gender in your field, and would you be able to speak more about this spectrum of gender and the identities that you focus on in your research?
Sure. If you don't mind, I'll start with sex and then move to gender. Sex is generally described as binary, male or female. But really, that's not a complete picture either, because there's a percentage of the population who are intersex, children, babies that are born with markers of both male and female, so they're intersex. And oftentimes in the West, they are forced, their parents might choose the binary. So they pick whether the child will be male or female and raise them in such a way. Native Americans or other indigenous cultures don't always force that binary. So by and large, though, we think of sex as binary, with the exception of the intersex that I was just telling you. Gender is more of a social construction. So this is the degree to which someone may identify with being more masculine or feminine in their approach. Mm-hmm. So I see gender as a representation from very, very masculine to very, very feminine, and it's people's perceptions of their leadership that really impact the bias that could occur. Mm-hmm. So we expect in our culture, in the United States context, that women will be kind and nurturing, and men are more decisive and action-oriented, for example. But in leadership, we tend to think of leaders being decisive and action-oriented. And when a woman acts in that way, she's going against her gender norms. Mm-hmm. So there are backlashes that can occur. So I've kind of gotten off the path there of how to define gender and sex, but it all comes back to leadership, in that there are perceptions that society has about what a leader should act like and what a woman or a man should act like. And when you put those two things together, it can produce a double bind where women may not be seen as both likable and competent at the same time.
Wow. Right. Yeah, that's a very insightful take. And I think also that right now, even today, men are seen as very patriarchal. They have to show a strong figure in the political field and leadership. And I do think that is some kind of social norm that we should try and deconstruct, because women can also take that stance. Women do not need to be fragile and sincere and loving just to be a role model. So I was wondering if you would be able to touch more upon what have you found the most problematic in the history of leadership in the context of sex and gender and the spectrum?
There's a lot that we can go through, and I'm glad we have some time. The first piece is, as an advocate for gender equity, you know I study women in leadership primarily, and that's where my passion is. However, I'm also an advocate, as is my co-author Cheryl Tan, one of your members of KLI. Mm-hmm. We are both advocate for an expansion of masculinities, the representation that men can have of being more masculine or more feminine in their gender representation. So it's not that we only want to see more women as leaders. We also want men to feel like they can be expressive of their emotions, kind, nurturing, stay home with the kids, go to the soccer games, take paternity leave if that's what comes, whatever, be stay-at-home dads. So it's an expansion of the gender norms for men just as much as it is expansion of the gender norms for women. So that's where I'll begin that piece. But I think what really surprised me in writing a textbook we started off with kind of some historical perspectives. And when our country was founded, our leaders, presidents, Thomas Jefferson being one, met with the people of the Iroquois Confederacy in upstate New York. And they observed the ways in which leadership took place. They weren't strictly a matriarchal society, but it was women, it was the clan mothers who decided whether or not the tribe would go to war, for example. They controlled many of the financial resources. They helped select the chief of the tribe. Women had a very important role in this society. At the same time, the women in colonial America didn't have any rights. Mm-hmm. And so not like that. They didn't have voter rights, right? They didn't have a say in who the president would be. Yeah. They couldn't own property if they were married. If you were single, you know, that was different. So I think having suffrage based on owning property and not giving women that right to vote, to have a say early on in the days of our country, that was really surprising to me. We took much from the laws of England, and that's how they did it with property-based suffrage. And so what would our country look like had we borrowed more from the Native Americans, from the Iroquois Confederacy back then? Where would we be today with gender equity?
Wow. Yeah, that's a great point. And I wanted to go back and touch on what you were talking about expanding masculinities. And in our first discussion of gender, I was wondering, how can we ensure a framework, especially when we're talking about leadership, that not just involves women, but also trans and non-binary individuals, those with intersecting identities, and also men who might face backlash for going against these norms?
I think, especially at this moment in time, when we have seen some challenges to DEI initiatives, shall we say, and definitions of gender that are more restrictive than perhaps we have seen in the past. Mm-hmm. Now is the time to create a blueprint. I think we have all heard recently at the conference earlier today that joy is a form of resistance. And I will also say that in these times of seeming hopelessness, sadness, now is the time to create the future that you want to see. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible to get together and be nitty-gritty and work it out and say, this is what we want the future policies to be. You said you were studying public policy. Mm-hmm. This is what I think the ideal future should be in terms of gender equity. So make your plans now so that as we keep going in these next several years, we'll be ready to go. We've already seen this happen. I was just talking to a woman here in California recently who was telling me that gay marriage was something that was illegal in the United States, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and it's not now. But it took time, and it took times of when things were seemingly hopeless that they were creating the blueprints. They were creating the plans for how to make these things happen, make marriage equality legal. So we can borrow from the examples that have already been put in place here in the United States and say, how can we do the same thing for gender equity?
Yeah. That's great advice for a lot of the government and public policy-minded folks we have here at Claremont McKenna, getting that initiative started right now.
Yeah, and also, so you talk about this blueprint that we're trying to make, a framework. How has research that you've been doing and you plan to continue doing going to create and contribute to creating this blueprint for others and for yourself in the industry?
One of the people, as you know, who works here at KLI, Cheryl Tan, and I are co-chairing a conference on women and leadership, which will take place June 11th through 13th, right here on your campus at Claremont McKenna. And it's the 7th International Leadership Association Conference on Women and Leadership. And we believe that especially now in this time, we're going to talk about planning a conference and talk about the elephant in the room. I'm using air quotes with my fingers as if you could see me, but the elephant in the room of how can we, as a group of people getting together at a conference, not just share ideas about pre-planned proposals that have been submitted and gone through the review process, but also work on beginning these ideas of putting ideas up like on poster boards of like, where, what should this blueprint look like moving forward? And so all of the conference participants were going to be invited to start putting these ideas up. So in addition to those regular sessions that and the keynote speakers that we'll have, we're also going to begin those blueprint discussions as well.
Oh, very cool.
That's amazing. So this is going off on a little bit of another topic, but something I found very interesting about your background is your experience with observing and interacting with women leaders on an international scale and teaching classes for women in leadership in Bahrain as well as in Saudi Arabia. And I was wondering briefly, if possible, you could speak to some of the challenges and circumstances you viewed when you look at gender equality dynamics in places outside of the U.S.
Sure. I think I learned a lot. Sometimes we were talking earlier about silos, and you know, even in the United States, we have our own silos of what we think women should do and what they should look like, and we should have freedom of expression and how we speak and how we vote and what we wear and all of these things. And I think my initial impressions when going to the Middle East was, oh, are these women oppressed? And what I've learned is, in many ways, they were stronger leaders than I was. The women might be wearing hijab or abaya, but they were taking greater risks than I was to advocate for gender equity. And so I have come to appreciate that we all have a piece of the truth, and there's no specific one way that we can become the best leaders, whether it's, you know, context matters. Mm-hmm. So how women may do that in other countries may look different than how we do it here. And I think we have to have respect for women all over the world, that it may not look exactly like we think it should look, but champion them and say, what do you think are the best ways to get there? And listen to the women who are having boots on the ground, so to speak, who are actually living in certain circumstances. Let's not decide here in California where, what people in other countries should be doing. Let's have them decide what's the best way. I'm not saying that I'm certainly open to human rights right everywhere, but I think people themselves have to design what they think their own gender equity plans should be and look like.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I guess similarly on that, I was wondering if with this international scope you now have, has your perspective on equality dynamics in the U.S. changed? And has your approach to teaching women and gender minority leaders or even researching topics in this discussion, has any of that changed now that you have that international focus?
It has. And if I might be vulnerable enough to say, I've looked at my own life as one way to understand gender diversity or gender on a spectrum or cultural differences. I am a first-generation, low-income college graduate from Appalachia. What does that mean exactly? It means, I think some people who had never met me but heard that description might have certain ideas in their head about what a low-income woman might look like or what a first-generation college graduate might look like. And they may not give her the full benefit of the doubt. And so for me, in my specific example, low-income meant that I got free lunches at school. It meant that I wore hand-me-down clothes. what does first-generation college graduate mean? It meant neither of my parents had gone to college before I did. My grandmother went to fourth grade. My grandparents on both sides of my family were immigrants to this country. So if I think about my own experience going through life, and I didn't want people to judge me negatively, I think I owe that to the other people that I am now interacting with, whether it is gender minoritized people or people from different cultures and contexts in other places around the world, is how can I meet them where they are, right? So that's how I have used it, both in a very personal way from my own lived experience, but also from visiting other people in other countries and other contexts and meeting people of different gender identities than my own, is trying to bring that level of understanding and trying to have mutual respect.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that response with us. And I kind of resonate with that because I'm a first generation American. My parents immigrated here and they gave up so much just for me to be able to go to school and grow up in a great neighborhood with great friends and a great community, and then end up like at a college like Claremont McKenna. And I think it's very valuable to me that I get to carry a legacy like that. And especially as a woman that is learning how to be a leader, or I'm aspiring to become a leader in whatever field I decide, which I haven't yet. But I do think this is a very valuable legacy to hold. And I was wondering if you had a message to share with women like me, women like us, who are looking for something to guide them throughout the rest of their aspirations, and be able to be open-minded about challenges that they might face and the way they have to look at how other people are facing challenges in their lives.
I think you will have to balance things perhaps differently. I think we all do, but sometimes we think there's a quote-unquote American way a woman should do things. And sometimes I'll say ethnic women or people who have backgrounds or ties to other countries where gender norms were different. Mm-hmm. The gender norms, well, just I think over time have changed. But also, I'll say from the old country, that's how my grandparents would talk about it. They would talk about being in the old country. That it's okay to have a foot in both camps. And I feel like I did. I had to be true to myself and my cultural heritage, as well as be true to whatever ideal I think I had in my head of being an American woman. And so maybe that looks different for you, Vivian, than it does for you, Nathra, right? But don't give up on those family and cultural roots. Bring them with you. I used to hide the fact that I was a first-generation, low-income college graduate, right, from Appalachia. If we were having this podcast 5 years ago, I never would have said that. And I think it's okay. It's who you are when you talk about your parents being immigrants to this country. I think it's something to be celebrated. And so now I think of these things more as my superpower, more than a disadvantage.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we just have one last question for you, and it has to do with what the future of leadership for gender minorities and women will look like. I was just wondering, do you think that there's any gaps in research and advocacy that you're especially going to have to address in the upcoming years? And in general, how do you see the future of your work?
We keep talking about Cheryl Tan and I, and she's my number one writing partner. So Cheryl and I co-edited a book a few years ago called Gender and Leadership. And in it, there were recommendations that there absolutely indeed needs to be more research on the LGBTQ community and people who have different intersecting identities and how they are perceived as leaders, how they are perceived as followers. And as we learn more, you know more, you'll do better once you know better. And so I think we need that research to move in that direction. I don't have a research project right now that is specifically going in that direction, but I feel like I am taking on a writing project that is an act of leadership, and it's about myself. So I'm writing a memoir, and I have 180 pages, and I'm really looking forward to fine-tuning and editing it over the next year and hopefully getting it published, because I want other women to feel inspired. In my life, it was because of the factors I mentioned earlier that I felt a little held back or a little disadvantaged or a little veiled, if you will, like I didn't want to share those pieces. That's what it was for me. But I think many women have something that's inside that they want to keep covered and not share and hide. And I think if I can share my story, that maybe it will encourage other women to share their stories and become who they were meant to be as women leaders. And so I see this act of writing a memoir, I see writing a memoir an act of leadership, of actually encouraging other women to grow into their full personhood and become the leaders that they really wanted to be. So not research specifically on gender, but a different path.
Yeah,
personal
absolutely.
Story. Yeah.
Thank you so much. We really look forward to reading your memoir. Hopefully within the next couple years.
I hope so.
We have it in this office with Dr. Tan. And I hope that your memoir gives other women the ability to unveil themselves and take control and create their own blueprints and follow their paths and their true calling to leadership.
That's my hope. That's my hope. Fingers crossed.
So I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming here today. We appreciate your time. And this is a very special day because it is the intersection of Women's History Month, International Women's Day, and our 30th annual Kravis Day Roulette Conference, which you attended today, which was awesome.
It really was. And it's so special to be here with you today. Thank you for inviting me to be on the podcast. It means a lot to me to get to share my story, coming all the way from West Virginia to be here for the conference.
Yeah. It was amazing to have you. Thank you so much.
And it means a lot to us, too, that you were here today, because to be able to speak vulnerably to another woman in leadership as aspiring women in leadership is very valuable to us. And I know it'll be valuable to whoever ends up listening to this podcast. We're very honored to have gained your perspective and insight on gender inequality and paths to take to be a better leader. And once again, thank you so much for joining us today on the KLI Illumin podcast.
And thank you both. And I wish you the best as you continue your role as a podcast host. Is it just this semester or throughout the year?
Hopefully it's for the next 4 years.
Okay. Awesome.
All goes well. Yeah.
Well, I'll look forward to listening to the podcasts that you host.
Thank you so much for your time. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Thank you.